You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programme. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
I walked up to him. I gave him the handshake of the Master Mason. He immediately grabbed me, took me into the 5 points of fellowship, and whispered Mahabon in my ear. You know what I did? I said, Mahabon my ass.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A shot across the bows as 34 innocent people were killed by terrorists in Russia and dozens more seriously injured. The Sochi Olympics just a month away. Yes, we're looking ahead to 2014. Also, Monday sees the first barrister strike in Bristol for 700 years. It's all over cuts to criminal legal aid, and lawyers are saying these changes, started by UK Bilderberg Supremo, now being carried on by Justice Secretary Chris Grayling, will mean the end to justice in Britain, as only the rich will be able to afford to pay for justice. Also, as totalitarian one-party China decide to finance a nuclear power station at Hinkley, it will be operated by one of the most corrupt, that's official, energy companies, EDF, who are conning their, and have been fined for conning their customers. But will the Hinkley power station really ever happen? But we start this week with Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Hi, Will. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening, Tony.
First of all, Will, we will pick up where we left off last time you were in here a few weeks ago, where we were talking about disciplinaries and grievance procedures and your basic rights as an employee. One of the things we're hearing all the time, I mean, including with this whole business of legal aid being taken away in many areas, is that your rights as an employee are being cut away all the time. Rights for trade unionists as well. So what is the situation if you feel like how do people know if they are being sacked or being bullied at work? How do you know whether there's actually anything legally that you can do about it?
Well, bullying at work is quite an interesting one, because a lot of people do contact us at the Law Centre and say that they're being bullied at work and want to know what they can do. I always have to say the same thing to them, which is straightforward bullying and harassment at work is not a claim that you can take against your company. The only way you can do it is by saying that they breached your contract. It's different if the bullying and harassment is related to your race, or to the fact that you're a woman, or that you're a man, or a disability, or your sexual orientation, or your religion, or your belief, because there you can take a claim of discrimination under the Equality Act 2010.
But isn't the fact that most people don't want to take any of those claims, because they're thinking to themselves, actually, I just want to ingratiate myself to my employer. If I start taking legal cases against them, that's just going to make matters worse. I might lose my job completely.
That's right, and it's more difficult to do that now. You can take out a grievance. ACAS have a statutory code. That's a statutory code that means that employers ought to have regard to it. It can be used as evidence against them if they fail to do so. You take out a grievance under your employer's grievance procedure. That's the way to do it. Unfortunately, what I tend to see a lot is that grievances aren't upheld, particularly where they're to do with bullying and harassment by managers. The employee then takes out a further grievance about the way that the grievance has actually been handled by the management, and you get a kind of, as I say to people quite often, you have to be careful that you don't get this snowballing effect where you've got in so many grievances that it causes you so much stress, you go off work with sickness, and the next thing you know, it's very difficult for you to return to work because of the atmosphere, and you're facing dismissal on grounds of long-term sickness, otherwise known as capability.
But coming back to the original question, how do you know whether or not you are actually being bullied. Sometimes people may think, well, I'm just having a joke with you, and yet you may take that the wrong way. How can you actually identify whether there is actually bullying going on, whether or not you can actually do anything about it?
Well, the sensible thing to do would be to take a grievance, and the sensible thing for the employer to do would be to investigate it and ask people the reason why they are treating you in the way that they are, to properly investigate it. It's an insidious thing, because people feel very got at if they're being bullied. It could sometimes just be a new management style, a very hard-hitting management style. An employer may bring in a new manager, and they may have a different style which the employees don't like. And it's often difficult to get people to see that what could just be a different management style is bullying or harassment. And employers tend to protect their managers as well. The other difficulty that you've got, of course, is where people are being treated to harassment. It might be, as you've just said, where the quite often, and this is often used even by employers when investigating, is just, oh, well, it was just a bit of office banter. People do that all the time. You need to get the person who is taking that kind of action against you to see that it is upsetting you, to see that it is offensive. The way to do that, really the only procedure to do that, is to take out a grievance.
Okay. What about the way that legal aid has been affected over the last year or so? Can you just give us an idea of what used to be covered by legal aid and isn't now? And also, what's left? What can you still use legal aid for?
Well, my particular area of law, which is employment and discrimination, particularly employment, 2013 has been quite an unlucky year, because legal aid was taken away from employment cases altogether. So up until April 2013, we were able to advise people and to assist them in tribunal claims, preparing those claims for them under legal aid. We can't do that anymore, so it's very limited with the work that we can help people with. If they have a claim that involves discrimination, we can help them under our Tackling Discrimination service, which is a new service which was launched this year, funded by Bristol City Council. It's quite unique to Bristol. There's the only one other similar service in the country, and that's called Tackling Discrimination in the East, which is run by Suffolk Commission for Racial Equality. So those are good things for people in Bristol. They're good things for people in Norfolk and Suffolk. But for the rest of the country, I'm afraid, it's pretty bleak.
So withdrawing the withdrawal of legal aid for employment tribunal cases, how has that actually affected how busy these courts are? I mean, how much money would somebody normally have to... I mean, I imagine it gives a ballpark figure. How much it would actually cost if you were to try and take one of these privately, one of these tribunal cases against your employer?
The figure that's usually given by a moderate-sized firm of solicitors who would take those cases is around £3,000 to go all the way to a hearing. Employment tribunals were set up to be low-cost, to be simple to use, in order for employment disputes to be resolved in a very simple and straightforward matter. History, the way that that's evolved over the past 30, 40 years, 50 years has meant that, because, and I think it's really the fault has to be laid at the door of the employers, who've insisted on employing very expensive lawyers in order to defend claims, and that has meant that the employees have gone and received legal aid in some cases, or have gone to solicitors themselves, and so the employment tribunals have become a bit more like a court. They've been a bit more litigious. The other thing that's come in for the first time this year is employment tribunal fees, and it's now, if you wanted to take a claim, for example, if you felt you'd been discriminated against because of your race, if you wanted to take that claim in an employment tribunal, to go all the way to a hearing would now cost you £1,200, with no guarantee that you would get that back even if you won. That's had quite a staggering effect on the number of employment tribunal claims. Now, I've got some statistics from the Bristol Employment Tribunal, Which covers quite a large area around Bristol in the southwest. In June 2013, for example, an average kind of month, they accepted 157 claims. In July 2013, that shot up because people were trying to get their claims in before the fees came in. So that figure doubled to around 300. After July, that figure fell a staggering amount, 64 claims only were accepted in August. That went down to 35 in September and has gone down to an average figure of around of about 40 to 50 cases per month. So a lot of people are not taking claims that they could be taking.
Well, this is connected with the criminal legal aid being taken away as well. And barristers at Bristol Crown Court, we're told by the Bristol Post, are set to strike over proposed cuts to legal aid on Monday. That's the 6th of January. They claim victims and witnesses will suffer as the quality of justice will fail. Barristers fear the funding reduction will lead to a two-tier system with only the wealthy able to afford the best representation. Well, that's interesting. That's kind of what you were saying there as well, Will. Even with legal aid, sometimes businesses will pay much, much more for their lawyers, maybe even 10 times more than an individual. The Ministry of Justice believes the reforms will save £220 million a year from 2018-2019. And barristers involved in long-running legal aid cases could face 30% cuts in their fees. The Ministry of Justice says around £2 billion a year, Britain has one of the most expensive legal aid systems in the world and has no choice but to make savings. Well, that £2 billion legal aid also covers you, Will. Would you agree with that? That we don't actually have any choice but to make these savings. £2 billion, it's going to save us a year.
Well, it swings around about, doesn't it? Because where is that money going to be spent afterwards? So if you reduce the amount of legal aid that you spend in defending people and criminal charges, are you going to end up with more people in prison? That's going to cost you probably the same amount of money as you've just saved. There's probably going to be much more of a risk of miscarriages to justice. That's going to cost a lot more, because if people are taking cases on miscarriages of justice, then the costs of paying out compensation, on the costs of actually sitting the appeal court sitting, those costs are just going to pop up somewhere else. So it's probably not really going to be, at the end of the day, such a huge saving.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, let's just bring you in on this, because this does seem like a massive change to our judicial system that's going on here. And what the barristers are saying, it's going to be a two-tier system with only the wealthy able to afford the best representation.
Well, that's clearly part of the object of the exercise, almost. I think it's partly to save money, but it's also because, you know, rights are being taken away from people at the bottom in society, and people at the top are basically asserting themselves and chucking their weight about.
And what do you think is going to be the knock-on effect of this withdrawal of legal aid, both for in these criminal cases and also in these employment cases that Will's
doing? I won't comment on what the effects will be legally. Perhaps Will could comment on that. But I mean,
socially, then.
Yeah, I would point out that this cutting of public expenditure is a silly policy in any case. The idea that there isn't any money and that therefore we've got to cut back.
What's the reason for it then, if you say it's silly?
Because we've bailed the banks out, who should have been allowed to either allowed to crash, or if you're going to bail them out, you've then got to reform them, and then we've got no money to pay for sensible things that we need to pay for, like employment tribunals. Now, we mustn't get locked into this idea that there's no money, what are we going to cut? There's plenty of things we can cut. There's plenty of military adventures we could cut, for starters. But in any case, it doesn't do any good to the macroeconomy to keep chopping money out of the economy for poorer people, whether it's legal aid or benefit payments or whatever. Ultimately, the economy won't work if you do that. You've got to redistribute wealth within a capitalist economy, otherwise it topples over. And that's the danger that we're getting into, is that by pursuing this kind of ideological crusade, they're actually going to bring on another crash with all of the consequences.
Now, I keep hearing from left-wingers that there's an ideological crusade and this whole thing of it being ideology. What's the ideology there? What is the end game? What's the end point of what is trying to be achieved here by cutting this legal aid bill?
Well, I mean, but what's happened this year is that both David Cameron and George Osborne have come out of the closet and said, when they first got elected, they said, nobody goes into politics to cut things. We've got to cut things to balance the books, but we don't really want to do it. But we've got to do it because times are hard and that's the situation. But this year, and also with Boris Johnson, they've all come out and said, actually, we want a smaller state. We want a smaller state all round. We want a state more like the state in the United States of America, where we don't provide benefits, we don't provide legal aid, we don't provide healthcare, because that's what we really want. And they've come out and said that, because, of course, there's an internal battle going on within the Conservative
Party.
Well,
the point for that,
and
surely.
They're all suddenly saying, actually, we're going to carry on cutting, even when we don't have to cut,
because that's what we want anyway. It encourages people not to be so dependent on the state.
Yes, but that's just silly talk, really. Some people are dependent on this. If you get ill or sick or whatever, you depend upon society to look after you. Now, only very wealthy people can afford to say that's nothing to do with me. But, of course, 75% of British MPs are millionaires. 75%. Now, how representative is the House of Commons, then, of the British population? How representative?
Not very. Certainly not round here, around this table, I don't think. Anyway, I don't know if you're a millionaire. I doubt it, are you?
Unfortunately not.
Okay.
Unfortunately, maybe not.
Let's just go back to what you were saying. The positive side, really, is that we do have this equalities programme that you're able to help with here. Have there been any successes over the last year or so with that, Will? Give us an idea of the sorts of equalities cases that you've been able to take.
Well, we've had some very successful cases where we have raised matters where disabled people, for example, I mean, there was a case that was publicised early in the year about a disabled user of a leisure centre who wasn't able to use the leisure centre because the leisure centre was saying that her carer would have to pay to go with her. And we raised that with them. They agreed that they had in fact made a mistake, and the matter was successfully resolved by her being given two free season tickets for her and her carer to attend at the leisure centre. Now, that probably wouldn't have had such a good result if it had had to go to court. So one of the good things about the service that we've got is that we can, through the contacts that we've got in the equalities team in Bristol City Council, actually get straight to the services concerned and to speak to them round a table rather than to threaten them with court proceedings. And that's a good thing. And we've had several successful cases going round that route.
Now, as a sort of last gaze back at what we're losing, thanks to Chris Grayling and Ken Clark, give us an idea of the sorts of employment cases that you were able to win under legal aid, not going into specific details, but the general idea. I mean, obviously, for most employees, they think, well, if they're going to get the sack, then that's it. And only occasionally do people think, well, maybe actually this is unjust and I can fight this. So give us an idea, Will, of what successes you've had in the past under employment law.
Particularly with what I would call straightforward, unfair dismissal cases, where there's no discrimination involved, where somebody has been unfairly dismissed, where the reason hasn't shown to be a sufficient reason for a dismissal. We've taken the cases to the tribunals, and the tribunals have agreed with us, and the claimants have received some justice. They've received some compensation for the dismissal that they received. The other area where we've had quite a lot of success is in getting people who have won tribunal cases by taking them themselves, have been awarded compensation, and then the employer hasn't paid up. That happens an awful lot. And we have been able to use legal aid, to use the enforcement procedures to ensure that the bailiffs are sent in to the employers, that their goods and services and their vehicles maybe are seized. And then when they see that the claimant is being serious about this, then they do pay up.
One of the problems with this, of course, Martin, is that it means that quite often bad employers, ruthless employers, will get more money and prosper.
Well, yes, it's a race to the bottom, isn't it? I mean, ultimately, I would envisage Britain being a kind of society where people's rights are respected at work, and that will encourage them to be happier people and more productive workers. The idea that the best way to get the best out of people is to put the fear of God into them, keep them terrified of losing their jobs. A lot of people, we've not seen unemployment rising as much as it did in the 80s, although of course we've still got a massive unemployment problem, but conditions at work have definitely deteriorated for people. And ultimately, of course, this shortens people's lives, it makes them ill. The quality of life of ordinary people is being ground down bit by bit, day by day.
Sounds a little bit depressing, Will, but you say you've still got, you're still doing these sort of equalities cases. Can people still come to you for advice, free advice, that sort of thing, at the Haven and Bristol Law Centre?
Oh, of course they can, yeah. We are still running our two employment advice lines, which are on a Tuesday afternoon and a Wednesday morning, where people can get some advice. They can discuss their cases with them. Any employment matter we can deal with. We also have a very good service from volunteer solicitors from private firms who come into the Law Centre, and we'll see people face-to-face and give them, it's a half an hour, three quarters of an hour of advice, and can help them on assessing whether or not they have a claim that they can take, whether it's worth them taking the claim, bearing in mind, especially now, that you have to pay a fee. Although there is a fee remission system, that has shown to been incredibly badly run, and lots of bad decisions made and people being refused fee remissions where they were entitled to it. One thing that we're waiting to see is one of the trade unions, I think it's Unison, I'm not 100% sure, are actually challenging the introduction of tribunal fees in the High Court on the grounds that it is unlawful under European law. We're still awaiting the decision on that, but it'll be useful to see what happens.
Okay, give us an idea of the sort of broad spectrum of the different types of cases that you will listen to and give advice on at Avery and Bristol Law Centre then, Will.
Well, wages, people who feel that their wages haven't been paid correctly, if they've had deductions from their wages that they think aren't right, if they're having problems at work, it might be bullying, it might be harassment, if they've been suspended from work, if they're under disciplinary proceedings, if they're having problems with colleagues at work, all of those matters are things that we can advise on, and people can ring us on the helpline. If I can give the number, which is 0117 916 7727, 916 7727, and that's on a Tuesday from 4 to 6 and from a Wednesday from 10 until 12 noon.
Okay, what's your main phone number and whereabouts can people find you online?
People can find us at www.ablc.org.uk. They can also find us down on Stokes Croft, just up from the Bear Pit, next to the Full Moon Pub, and they can ring our reception on 0117 924 8662.
Will Stone from Avon Bristol Law Centre, a happy 2014 to you, and thanks very much for joining us.
And the same to you.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Okay, Martin, let's go back now to having a little look and gaze into 2014. We've got something called the Still Report. It's done every month or so by Bill Still, and he's had a look at the outlook for 2014. So let's start now by seeing what Bill Still has got to say for himself. And he's looking at elections, and also he's looking at the same sort of things that you and I have been talking about so far, which is this systemic financial crisis right across the Western world.
2014 will be a tipping point year for human freedom worldwide. Human freedom is tipping at the edge of a death spiral. This coming year may determine whether we humans will find an escape mechanism. History has shown that individual freedom can only flourish when we, the people, take charge of our governance. But there is a certain segment of society that will always try to undermine self-governance in any way they can. These people range from the maniacal dictators who want to monopolize political power by force to the plutocrats who know the secret is to monopolize the money power. By 2014, voters will head to the polls in not only the U.S., but across 28 nations, electing representatives to the European Parliament, as well as in India, Brazil, and Indonesia. But in recent years, voter turnout has been steadily declining, from around 80% down towards 60%. Why? Because voters wonder if their vote counts. They are losing buy-in. The root cause of this buy-in is clear. The debt money system forces money into fewer hands, and that causes political power to become less and less democratic. Transnational organizations, the worst of which is the European Union, magnify the dissatisfaction. By one estimate, over 80% of Great Britain's laws are now not made in London, but in the European Parliament. This helps foster a growing feeling of helplessness when it comes to the political side of the equation. The bad guys are successfully deepening political divisions within nations by steering all political debate into a false dichotomy, either the austerity camp or the borrow-and-spend welfare state camp of national monetary policy. But neither will work because neither addresses the root cause, the debt part, personal, corporate, but most of all, government debt. Since neither solution will work, both sides become more frustrated and will tend to elect ever more radical candidates promising reform but never delivering. This political sleight of hand gives the money masters more and more time to deepen their political control by disempowering national sovereignty, their most important aim. But it also gives the Orwellian crowd more time to destroy the last vestiges of personal privacy, a core requirement for humans to feel free. But let's not forget, without monetary reform, there can be no sustainable self-governance. I'm still reporting on the economy for the last time in 2013. Happy New Year!
Well, he's giving us a really depressing message, Martin, in a kind of fake Happy New Year at the end there. But ultimately, what he's saying is surely right, is that actually, unless there's some kind of fundamental reform to the money system, none of this is going to change.
Yeah, and I think there's got to be a fundamental reform to the money system, but reforming the money system is not enough. These people have got all sorts of other power besides money power. And reforming the money system is important, but it's not a silver bullet. Ultimately, democracy is about struggles between different interests. It's all in Aristotle's Politics. Democracy becomes oligarchy step by step as the oligarchs subvert the democracy. We've never had a real democracy, but the oligarchy is getting stronger and stronger. But ultimately, of course, they are many, we are few.
Well,
we are many, they are few.
They are many, we are few. No,
that's
I don't
the wrong
think
way
so.
Around.
One of the alternatives to the present money system, which certainly doesn't seem to be working very well, although it's working very well for some, of course, and not for others, and all this talk of austerity and financial crisis, well, actually, for a small minority of the population, in fact, you know, maybe you talk about maybe between, you know, 1% and 5%. A lot of people have done extremely well out of this so-called crisis.
Yep.
One of the alternatives that's being mooted is this idea of Bitcoin. This is a digital currency. A lot of discussion about it. Max Kaiser on the Kaiser Report seems to be very enthusiastic about it. But I know in the last month or so, there's been quite a lot of questions raised about whether Bitcoin is really going to be any kind of real solution for the future. I remember seeing the money system discussed. This is probably 10, 15 years ago. And the way it was put was that the financial elite like to have pieces on both sides of the chessboard. So, in other words, they are creating a system which is the system we're dealing with now. But they also like to control any alternative system. So as people think, well, I want to go to do something different, that's also controlled by the same people. And I wonder whether that's the case with Bitcoin. Am I being a bit too paranoid there?
No, I mean, Bitcoin has massively increased in value, which means that people think, oh, if I buy a Bitcoin now, I'm going to make myself rich. that is not the basis for a stable currency which allows people to plan and plan for the future in terms of investments and so on. It's a fad. Don't forget, to use Bitcoin, you've got to have access to a computer, and perhaps one-third of humanity doesn't have access to electricity, never mind computers. So it's very much for the rich boys, isn't it? And, of course, the other thing is that you can lose things like this can easily just turn into Ponzi schemes where you put your money and then you lose the lot. That
so,
can happen.
So, I mean, what these Bitcoins, actually, they have actually produced real coins of these as well, these Bitcoin things. But it's a digital currency. What is the advantage of going to something like that rather than pound or a dollar?
Well, I mean, one of the advantages, supposedly, is because it's digital, it can't be traced. And therefore, if you're doing drug deals, you know, people are selling illegal drugs over the internet for Bitcoin. And they can't be traced because they can't be traced. I would suggest to those people that the NSA can probably trace you. They're not letting you know that they can trace you, but they probably can. And the other thing is that ultimately, if the state isn't regulating a market for money, somebody else will be. All markets are regulated either by the mafia or by the government or by both. Nobody, there's no free lunch on that front.
One Bitcoin, we're told, at the end of last year, was worth around about $885, having risen from less than $100 at the start of 2013 to a peak of $1,200. So this currency does seem to fluctuate. Obviously, people are looking at the stock exchange. They're thinking, some of them, like you, Martin, well, hang on, how long can this last for? I might lose all my money. And they're looking at other things to invest in. And Bitcoin, it seems to be possibly a currency of the future.
Yes, but I mean, look at the change in value just over several months. Yeah. Now, that if it can go up that much in several months, it can go down that much in the same sort of time scale, and that's the problem. You put all your money in Bitcoin. I mean, this is what happened in Albania a few years ago, where people realised that their neighbours, by buying into this Ponzi scheme, were making, you know, big money overnight, and eventually they felt stupid if they didn't join in. But of course, eventually the thing crashes, and then you lose all your money. That's the potential problem. Bitcoin is no different from anything else. It's just a digital version of what people used to do without digital technology.
Earlier last year, the German government reached a decision regarding Bitcoin status, saying it is actually a currency, it's a unit of exchange, similar to a regional currency. Meanwhile, the French went a step further and founded Bitcoin Central, a real bank into which customers can deposit and transfer money in both Euro and Bitcoins. I mean, it's a little bit like the increase in the numbers of different political parties when you've got a society that's been unstable. Maybe what we're seeing here is an increase in the different number of currencies, because people are obviously looking at the major currencies like the dollar and thinking, well, this isn't a safe place to put my money anymore.
Yes, but there's no safe place necessarily. Ultimately, we've got to have monetary reform. I totally agree with the contribution made by the chap earlier, but of course he's rag-bagging all sorts of things in on the back of that. The real problem is lack of accountability. And most people in the world are struggling to get hold of any kind of money. Bitcoin money, dollars, pounds, the poor struggle. And all of these kind of solutions that are put forward by people who've got money in their pockets are strictly solutions for people with money in their pockets. So I read a lot of the sort of libertarian rights stuff on the internet, and they keep saying, what you've got to do is buy gold, buy gold, buy gold. I think, what am I going to buy gold with? What's any poor person going to buy gold with? Buying gold is for those who've got some resources in the first place, whether they've begged them, steal them, or whatever. And, all of this stuff is very individualistically focused. Ultimately, we've got to reform the system so that ordinary folk get a fair crack of the whip, and we're still a long way from that.
Well, just 47 individuals own nearly a third of all bitcoins. About 927 people control half of the entire currency, and there are just over 1 million holders of bitcoins. The vast majority just own a few crumbs.
Well, indeed, and ultimately, of course, what may happen is that those people will cash out at the right moment when it crashes, and everybody will lose their money. That's how these things operate. I mean, if you've seen the value of Bitcoin's rise by, you know, several hundred percent in 1 year, if something's too good to be true, it's a rule of thumb. If something looks too good to be true, you know what? It probably is too good to be true. And if it was a stable currency, which had a stable relationship to other currencies, it wouldn't actually be so attractive, would it? You might as well hold dollars. And because it's surging ahead there, everybody thinks, oh, great, let's get into bitcoins. But it's like getting into tulips, or getting into cocaine, or getting into anything. you could get out of your depth quite quickly.
Okay, also staying on the financial side of things and trying to taper, going a little bit deeper this week rather than most of the time we're looking at specific stories, but what I'm trying to do is go a little bit deeper. The Co-op Bank suffered horrendously last year. It's been now bought up by US hedge funds. First of all, Martin, what is a hedge fund?
Well, hedging, the concept of hedging is that if you buy something, so I don't know, say coal, let's just say coal, for example, that fluctuates in price. So what you also do is you buy another financial instrument which is equal and opposite to the financial instrument that you're using, so that either way you won't lose money. So hedge funds were originally set up to deal with things like fluctuations in the supply of pork bellies, for example, which could float around all over the place. So hedging allowed you, so that if you know the bottom fell out of the pork belly market, then you'd be able to claim. It's almost like insurance, if you like. But of course, proper insurance companies assess risks properly, and they've got massive resources to back them up if they have to pay out, and they're very heavily regulated. The hedge fund world, the derivatives world, basically you are buying insurance, but it won't necessarily pay out. And ultimately, of course, we've built a huge derivatives market now. What's it Jordan Brown said, $900 trillion derivative market. That is a disaster waiting.
Well, why? Because surely the whole point of these derivatives is they're there to give some sort of certainty for the future. If people think that they may not be able to cope with a big fluctuation in a commodity price, for example, what they're doing is they're buying derivatives and they're trading derivatives to make sure that they can afford that commodity at the time.
Yes, but what
enables businesses to plan into the future, doesn't it?
But what people are doing there is making the logical mistake of thinking that when I do something to cover my risks, and they've used more and more complicated formulas to do this, CDOs squared and so on, the risk is then transferred to the whole system. So what's actually happened is that the risk has gradually, because people think there's no, once derivatives markets have allowed people to think, well, there's no risk. If I buy some coal here and I've taken a derivative against the price of coal falling, then there's no risk. And then because there's no risk, I'm going to buy more.
It does allow businesses to plan into the future, because sometimes, for example, a big fluctuation in a commodity price could knock out a company.
Yes. But don't forget that in the past, when you wanted to buy a commodity price market, you had to actually buy real commodities. Now, anybody can go into commodity markets just for speculative purposes. They were forbidden from doing that before the deregulation mania of the past 20 years. Now, let's put it this way, Tony. If I insure my house against fire and theft, then obviously I won't want my house to get burned or burgled, and I'm unlikely to try and steal, although I might try and steal. What if I take a bet that your house is going to be burgled or burned? Then I've got a vested interest in burgling or burning your house, have I not? And this is the problem. The derivatives market should never have been allowed to exist in the form that it does exist. Brooksley Bourne, who was the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US, tried to stop the derivatives market. And the derivatives market is fantastically profitable for those engaged in it. And the idea that we can't have a derivatives market is completely unthinkable to them. But I put it to you this way, Tony. We've survived for hundreds of years without a derivatives market of this kind, and we managed perfectly well.
One of the most nerve-wracking stories of the year was that the food prices are also being manipulated in this way.
Well, what's happening with quantitative easing and all the rest of it is that what it does is it forces up asset prices, and therefore that tips over into food prices. So food prices go up, inflation goes up, asset prices are protected. So those who hold assets, the already wealthy, are not just protected. They see their assets go up in value. Everybody else sees their living standards squeezed. Ultimately, that ain't sustainable. And it's not based on any kind of free market at all. It's a political decision to bail the banks out. And then money is then allocated upon political criteria. So we decide to bail out bankers, but not to bail out single mums. Single mums are scroungers. Bankers are not. But that's a political decision. It's got nothing to do with the market at all.
Back to the Co-op Bank, and that was founded on ethical principles back in 1872. It seems 2013 is the end of it. I mean, certainly there is still the cooperative group does have a holding, but the majority holding is by the hedge funds. Now, one of the reasons for all of this, there's two main reasons. One was that the government was considering selling Lloyds Bank branches, 600 branches of Lloyds Bank, and George Osborne and KPMG, the accounting firm, were behind that. That all fell through, and it cost the Cooperative Bank a fantastic amount of money because they basically invested as if this was going to happen. The other thing was the takeover of Britannia Building Society. That apparently has now caused them losses, a bit like the when HBOS were taken over by, I think it was by Royal Bank of Scotland, wasn't it? This has lost the Co-op Bank £250 million in 2012 alone. So it does look start to look as if these various deals have been extremely detrimental to the Co-op. Why have they done them in the first place?
Well, there are two reasons. I mean, basically, they should have carried on just doing what they were doing and being what economists call satisficing. In other words, we're not here to expand. We're not here to make a super profit. We're here just to be here. And, of course, that's the great strength of the co-op. So, for example, co-op shops do not actually have to make a huge profit, and therefore they will often keep a shop open, for example, in a council estate where it's not making a huge profit, but they don't have to make a huge profit. And that's the advantage of being a co-op, is that you're not being driven all the time to make maximum profit, and you can take other considerations into account. But, of course, what happened was they were being encouraged. It was from inside the bank, but also encouraged, as you say, by George Osborne, to take on
and KPMG.
Well, yes, to bite off more than they could do. You know, you don't want to do it like this. You want to do it like that. You want to think big. You want to be more ambitious. And of course, that's fatal. I mean, the Co-op Bank should have stuck to doing what it was doing, taking people's deposits and lending people money for small things. That's what they should have kept on doing, and they would have been all right.
Also, the board appointed Paul Flowers as a chairman, who had absolutely no experience in banking. Now, this would seem to be a bit of a no-brainer for organisations that are supposed to oversee such things like the Financial Regulation Authority.
Well, there's a question there for the financial regulators, obviously. Why was this guy allowed to be a head of a bank? I think one of the problems with the co-op is what happened was people like Flowers, who clearly didn't know what the hell was going on, they're parked in there to just sign off and rubber stamp all of these kind of ambitious plans by the managers to take over Britannia Building Society, to potentially take over the Lloyds Bank branches, and put somebody like Flowers, who clearly doesn't know anything about anything, is there just to sign all that off. But also, of course, being a sort of community person and representing the ordinary folk and all the rest of it. But I mean, that's just silly. I mean, basically, the managers should have been more competent and stuck to their own business rather than trying to expand. And people like Flowers should never have been brought in to prettify the situation.
Well, The Guardian did a rather good job. Rupert Jones, should I say, from The Guardian, on Wednesday, 23rd of October, ethical alternatives to the Cooperative Bank. For those wanting to keep their money in an ethical bank, of course, the co-op apparently officially is still an ethical bank, but I'm not sure how long that's going to last. There are current account options, including the Cumberland Building Society, Reliance Bank and Coventry Building Society, the Leeds Building Society, Metro Bank as well, and the Islamic Bank of Britain, which scores 74 on their scale out of 100, as does that Handel's Bank. A great little article, this, in The Guardian, because it also talks about savings accounts. Now, obviously, not all of us have actually got money, but if you have, it's nice to do something positive and helpful with it that isn't actually going towards, you know, financing arms firms and this kind of thing. Savings accounts, The Guardian points out that the Ecology Building Society is still there. The Loughborough, Market Harborough, Marsden and Progressive and Scottish and Darlington Building Societies, as well as Triodos and Charity Bank. Triodos is based in Bristol, I think, isn't it? Now, we also heard last week from Tony Crofts, who's organising, in a way, what is a kind of little building society of his own, to help convert empty offices in Bristol into low-cost, affordable housing.
Well, all of this is laudable, and I'm all in favour of ethical finance, but don't think that putting your money in an ethical investor is going to save you from a major capitalist crash, because it ain't. Basically, when the big banks go down, they will pull all these little banks down with them. And that, unfortunately, is the truth.
But ultimately, Martin, what is the actual effect of this is that one of the major high street chains around the country competing with people like Lloyds has now been taken out. It looks to me like, you know, it actually someone has, because I can remember 10 years ago there was a story, national news story, just a little blip on the news, saying that the co-op had found that one of their board members was actually spying on the board and reporting back outside. So do you think maybe possibly one of these big, powerful financial institutions somewhere else in the world, actually helped to take out
well,
the co-op bank?
A few years ago now, it's quite going quite a way back, there was a series of raiders from the City of London who wanted to take over not just the Cooperative Bank, but the Cooperative, full stop, the Cooperative Wholesale Society. Because the Cooperative Wholesale Society, in fact, owns lots and lots of property around the country. And, of course, they're not maximising the profit return on those on that property. They keep open, for example, shops which aren't making huge amounts of money just because they're a social service, and they also own property which they haven't sold off to maximise return, because the co-op, basically, as a co-op, is an extremely inflexible sort of setup. You know, there's got to be votes passed and resolutions and so on and so forth to do anything. But they borrowed money to buy up the whole cooperative portfolio, and they just hadn't done their research, because there was no way that cooperatives can just sell their assets to whoever turns up with some money, because basically they're not actually owned by an individual. There's all sorts of bureaucratic obstacles in your way if you want to buy up a cooperative property. And the people who were concerned with this bid to buy the co-op were just completely, you know, they just couldn't do it. But I mean, that's the point about the cooperative, is it's not there to be an HBOS or a Coutts or whatever. It's supposed to just stick to what it's doing. Just like Landsbanki and Icesave, before they were privatised in Iceland, used to do very boring things like take people's money and lend them money to buy houses or fishing boats. That was it.
So
that's all they did.
This little country, 400 miles, I think, north of us, yeah. North of the top of Scotland anyway, has roughly the same number, about 350,000 population as Bristol, the region around Bristol anyway, does. They have dealt with their financial situation. They're now actually looking much more positive. They're, for example, the gap between rich and poor is actually closing now in Iceland, as quite a lot of money is actually given to unemployed people, for example, to help kickstart spend into the economy. How much, it does beg the question, how much has employment actually got to do with how successful your country is? Because I wonder sometimes, I you know, a country may be doing very well economically, but actually people may be getting more and more unhappy and actually doing things that they don't want to do, not having enough leisure time, for example.
Well, I think in Scandinavian countries like Iceland, they've tried to get a balance between making money and being successful and having, you know, exporting into the international market and all the rest of it. But also at the same time getting the balance right in terms of making sure that, you know, children are educated, the older looked after, the weak in society are protected. And places like Norway and Iceland are, in fact, by far the most successful economically on the planet. And Finland, for example, their educational results are on a par with Singapore and Hong Kong. But they don't, in fact, have the same kind of educational methods. Scandinavian countries have always had a strong emphasis upon learning through play for the very young, and they don't have lots of exams. For example, in Finland, until you're 18, you don't take any formal exams, but their kids are, on the international measure, some of the cleverest in the world. Now, I think that is where Britain could and should have been if we hadn't had the whole history of the empire, our relationship with the Americans, our desire to dominate the rest of the world. We could have been a handy little North European country like Norway, Iceland, Finland or Denmark. But unfortunately, we've got all this history. I blame the Normans.
The Guardian on Wednesday this week, the China's military presence is growing. Does a superpower collision loom? This is Simon Tisdall saying this. Who holds the key to the future of East Asia? Interesting they're calling it East Asia, because that was from George Orwell's 1984 as well. As US influence recedes, arch enemies China and Japan are flexing their muscles. Now, we've also got China getting their tendrils into Somerset. I mean, some would say this is going to be wonderful for us. It's going to create loads of new jobs, building the third nuclear power station at Hinkley. This, Martin, does seem to be a bit strange, because it's pretty much still a totalitarian country, China, no free press. Some of the critics, for example, in China of the government are just simply executed.
Yeah, but I mean, the idea that we're not going to do business with China is laughable. I mean, basically British companies and European companies are doing business in China all the time.
So why,
if you're going to do business in China, why can't the Chinese do business here?
Why can't the City of London finance this power station? Why do we have to go to China?
Because in actual fact, nuclear power isn't economic, and they've had to actually subsidise it, and on that basis, the French nuclear state-owned nuclear power company and the Chinese state-owned nuclear power company are prepared to build Hinkley, provided the British taxpayer underpins it.
Well, sure,
and when people say money's being wasted, it's not being wasted on employment tribunals, it's being wasted on nuclear power. Nuclear waste in Britain costs a huge amount. We've got a huge pile of nuclear waste, which we developed during the Cold War and when we were developing our own nuclear power, and that actually costs far more than all sorts of other things that people think the money is being wasted on. It's actually being wasted on keeping nuclear waste safe. People have no idea what public money is spent on. They are consistently misled about it, and they mislead themselves about it.
What about this article was ultimately about? I mean, I sort of diverted there to talk about Hinkley, but they're saying that actually there's quite a conflict brewing between Japan and China.
Potentially, yes. They've now got competing claims over various islands in the South China Sea, and the Philippines is also implicated, and the Vietnamese. There could be a war in that region. It's quite feasible. Don't forget, economic crisis and crash means that politicians can't promise people a better tomorrow, but they can certainly give them some enemies to hate, and that's the danger.
Is that, you think, that the ultimate end game for the financial crisis, that it could end in war?
Yes. I mean, it could happen either way round. The war, for example, when we talked about attacking Syria this year, that could easily have caused a crash. Think about it for 2 minutes. If that war had gone on for any length of time, the markets would have crashed. The alternative is that there could be a crash, which then provokes a war, as everybody lashes out. Either way, it ain't good.
Well, the home end of this, of course, is the mass surveillance that we've all been put under. Now, for a lot of people, they say, well, I've got really nothing to hide. I don't really mind if the National Security Agency or GCHQ want to read my emails, know what my passwords are, that kind of thing, because I'm a reasonable, decent chap, law-abiding citizen.
Yes, but as I've been pointing out in the first hour, and I point out week after week on this programme, you can't trust the intelligence services to be on your side. They are, in fact, historically documented terrorists. So when you say, I don't mind MI5 and MI6 and GCHQ listening to my phone calls because I don't do anything terroristic, the answer is, yes, but they do. And they are collecting information so that they can pull strings further down the line, manipulate things, and so on. As I've said before, and I'll keep repeating it, this time last year, Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book based on decades of investigation by the Italian police force. NATO intelligence services were behind all the terrorism in Italy in the 70s and the 80s. And the suspicion has got to be that they're behind terrorist actions that are going on now, like the Boston bombing, for example, which clearly looks like a false flag attack.
Ultimately, what's going on is a collection of a massive database by GCHQ and the NSA on every single one of us.
Yeah.
So if anybody pops up that they want to have a look at, they've got a massive, massive profile on us.
Yes, they have. And proper terrorists who seriously know what they're doing, freedom fighters, whatever you want to call them, they can get round all of this. I mean, the Russian Secret Service have gone back to having paper files with a stamp on it saying top secret for your eyes only.
The problem, of course, is if you go back to the 1930s, this is exactly what the Nazis were doing. They were collecting massive amounts of information on every citizen in Germany. And then, of course, when they took over a country, Poland, France, whatever, that was the first thing that they did, is they would start collecting databases of people there. Then those databases were incorporated into what was called the Hollerith system. This is a fascinating book written by Edwin Black about this, called IBM and the Holocaust. And actually, Gestapo headquarters had these Hollerith machines in there. Well, you just have to press a button saying, I want to know the addresses of all of the Jews in Potsdam, for example. Yeah. They press a button, and out it would come. And, of course, almost all of us, as part of various surveys that we do, we talk about our religious affiliations, we talk about all sorts, and that will all be on this database. Now, the fact of the matter is that database now, as a political tool, is far more powerful even than Hitler had access to with these Hollerith machines in the 30s.
Yes, and also, as I've keep stressing, the people who are collecting this data are themselves suspects as terrorists. So it's when they say we've got to collect all this data to protect you from terrorists, they are terrorists, people collecting the data.
One of the most bizarre things about this is that these machines weren't even owned by the Nazis. They were leased throughout the war to them by IBM in the United States.
Well, yes, I mean, the deals are done, which the ordinary population are not necessarily fully informed. As I've mentioned to you before, Operation Cyclone, the setting up of Al-Qaeda as a group to fight inside Afghanistan in the 1980s, that's all there on the record, but people have kind of forgotten it. I mean, that's the reality. And, of course, the Iraqi resistance that drove the British and the Americans out of Iraq, and the Taliban-Afghan resistance, they know about electronic warfare, they know they're being bugged, and that's why they don't bother to communicate using electronic means. They've just deemed that the Taliban, for example, have now developed bombs, improvised explosive devices, which have no electronic or metal parts at all. And therefore, that's what they're putting their mind to. So all of the bugging in the world isn't going to find that bomb, because they just talk about it using ordinary voices. They build the bomb, they blow it up, and of course the electronic warfare communications facilities of the US and the British, totally useless.
Well, of course, the Iranians have also been very successful in hacking into drones and actually flying them. Well, you can imagine the sort of situation where you've got two people trying to control the same drone.
Also, just put it this way, Edward Snowden, a 27-year-old subcontractor, and he's just presumably one of thousands who are employed in this kind of industry, is able to walk out of the building with an MP3 with everything on it. When Daniel, I've forgotten his second name, the guy who did the Pentagon Papers,
Ellsberg.
When he sneaked,
he was at the Pentagon when the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
That's right. Well, I mean, he eventually sneaks out the Pentagon Papers about what was going on, what the planning, what was going on at the top level. But it took him months, if not years, because he had to photocopy every single document and then replace it and so on. Whereas Edward Snowden just downloads everything onto his MP3 and walks out of the building. That's the problem with all these complex systems, is that once they're compromised, they're compromised. What if the Iranians are able to bug all the missiles and drones that are being directed at them? Now, they've managed to bring two of them down, but just imagine if they've got more information than that.
Okay, Martin, in a nutshell, finally, what are your thoughts for 2014? I suppose the two most obvious hotspots are Sochi Olympics and Syria.
Well, Syria seems to have gone off the boil. The Sochi Olympics, hopefully, the Russians are pretty tough. I think they will protect the Sochi Olympics, no matter what threats are coming from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. I think the real danger, as we said earlier, is financial crash or war.
Time to sign off now, and I'm very pleased to say I wasn't expecting him, but Cyrus the Virus is floating around outside, so he'll be on after the news. Thanks very much to our guest Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre. You'll find us online. I'm afraid the BCFM website doesn't seem to be working very well at the moment. We've got a new site which still bits to sort out on there, but thisweek.org.uk will take you straight to this show and our archives still. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable 2014. Don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. Storms have brought heavy rain, strong winds and flooding, with more gales set to return tonight.